From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump issued a warning today to anyone planning to protest his rally in Tulsa tomorrow. He tweeted, quote, "Please understand you will not be treated like you have been in New York, Seattle, or Minneapolis. It will be a much different scene."
This is the president's first rally in months. The last one was on March 2nd, and it's being held indoors as daily COVID-19 cases increase in Oklahoma. The state Supreme Court is also due to rule today on whether social distancing and face masks will be required. Joining us now is Logan Layden, reporter and managing editor of State Impact Oklahoma, and he's been at the BOK Center today in Tulsa, where people are lining up a day before the event. And Logan, we're reading about the Republican mayor of Tulsa. He's declared a civil emergency and set a curfew for the area around the BOK Center. What have you seen today? And are people attending the rally worried about getting the virus?
As far as getting the virus, not from what I've seen. Went out and kind of strolled around the BOK Center within the last couple of hours. And what you see are people set up with tents, Trump supporters. Didn't really see anybody with any masks to speak of. Generally, this morning so far at least, it's pretty light as far as traffic and the number of people who are down there, but it's increasing as the day goes on. But as far as people within those groups trying to protect themselves, I didn't see a whole lot of that.
So this venue can hold up to 19,000 people. Attendees will have to sign a waiver saying that the Trump campaign isn't liable if they get the virus there. What kind of safety precautions will be taken? And is there any room for people to attend this rally outdoors?
Well, and there's still some questions around that. We know that the BOK Center holds about 19,000 people. We've also heard the administration say there'll be upwards of 60,000 people attending the rally, either at the BOK Center or across the street at the convention center, which, as far as I understand to this point, hasn't been authorized to be used as a venue for the rally on Saturday. But there is large parking lots, parking areas where you could get several tens of thousands of people into. And so, you know, it's still possible that there would be that many people in the area. Yeah. But as far as who's going to actually be at the rally, it's probably going to be around the 19,000. I haven't at least seen any sort of construction going up yet in the area as far as like big screens or any other way for people to stand outside and attend the rally sort of virtually. From outside, but that, you know, there's still time for that to happen. As far as the safety precautions within the facility itself, we're waiting on our state Supreme Court today to make a decision regarding that, whether it will be required that social distancing be maintained or that other safety precautions will be taken. We don't know what that decision is going to be yet. The state Supreme Court is having a special meeting today to look at that. But as of right now, I'm not aware of any specific rules for the people who are attending the rally to wear masks or to stay 6 feet away from each other. That doesn't appear to be the case so far.
We mentioned that tweet from the president about protesters. Are you expecting any?
Yes, there are a couple of protests that are sort of official and that we know are going to happen this evening in the Greenwood District here in Tulsa, which is within about a mile or so of the BOK Center, and which is the historical district where the Tulsa race massacre occurred nearly 100 years ago. There is an organized protest today, protest/celebration. It's already started, and there are, you know, food truck vendors, face painting. People are starting to gather down there to celebrate Juneteenth. Later today and into this evening, we're going to have people like Al Sharpton on the scene and Common and some other sort of higher profile people. And so we expect the sort of peak of that protest/rally/celebration to be later this evening in the Greenwood District, which again is still close, very close to the venue where the rally is going to be tomorrow night. And then also tomorrow evening, there's another organized protest in a Veterans Park here in Tulsa. Those are the two we know of. what we're waiting to see is what's going to happen in the meantime, and whether or not, whenever, you know, if Donald Trump is doing the rally at 7 o'clock, probably get out about 9:30. What sort of unorganized protests are going to have already gathered by then, and if these two groups are going to come together at some point.
So much to watch for and to report on. Yes. We appreciate this update. That's Logan Layden. He is reporter and managing editor of State Impact Oklahoma. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar has withdrawn herself from consideration to be Joe Biden's running mate in the presidential election. Klobuchar told MSNBC last night she is urging Biden to choose a woman of color to join him on the ticket.
This is a moment to put a woman of color on that ticket. And there are so many incredibly qualified women. But if you want to heal this nation right now, my party, yes, but our nation, this is sure a hell of a way to do it.
People on social media have had a lot to say about this. Let's bring in Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, for our weekly social media roundup. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy. I'm looking forward to unleashing Twitter pundits on you.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, let's start with that story. What kind of reaction are you seeing online to Klobuchar?
Well, Dr. Susan, she sounds exasperated. She says, it is time to put a flipping qualified person on the ticket. Great if person of color, great if a woman, but first a person of character with the nation and the world in mind. Educated, mindful, with integrity, please. John Hawkins says that Amy Klobuchar, who knew she wasn't going to get picked anyway, is deliberately trying to torpedo Elizabeth Warren. He is probably heat big mad at her right now. And then here's one that's really, really insightful, bearing in mind the framework that we're looking at right now and how many protests are going on around the country against police brutality. And Terrence Daniels says, she was a terrible choice because she literally represents the systematic racism we are fighting against. You picking her, Joe Biden, shows how little you had listened. George Floyd was killed in her state on her watch with her cops and her policies. So that brings us right back to where we are right now for this moment that we're having in the United States, looking at where we are with race relations, with the police relations, with people of color.
Well, and on that note, Twitter, for the fourth time, has labeled a tweet from President Trump as manipulated media as Twitter cracks down on misinformation. What is this latest tweet all about?
All right, Jeremy, I did not think that I saw this tweet last night from the president. I did not think that when I woke up today, I would still see the tweet. I was pretty much convinced it would disappear because it's kind of outrageous. But what you see, two little toddlers playing in the street and one chasing after another one. And then it has a fake CNN headline on it. Breaking news. Terrified toddler runs from racist baby. Now, that actual story was about the delightful little Maxwell and Finnegan, who are best friends. One is black, one is white, and they are huge friends. And whenever they see each other, they give each other giant, giant hugs. That is the real story. And there was just a little clip of them running away. And then that was where the racist toddler phrase came from. Apparently it was satire. Apparently it was a joke, but it didn't go down well with many people.
Well, what were people saying about it in reaction to it?
In reaction to it. So Starjammer, by sharing this at Real Donald Trump, you forfeit the right ever to complain about fake news ever again. Eugene, whose handle is Eugene G-U-M-D, everyone could tell that that CNN chyron was fake. That's the words that you see on the screen, and that it was satire. I mean, babies can't vote, but I have to say, Twitter slapping on a manipulated media label to this tweet is an awesome flex. Then one more thought for you, just because there's this debate still raging on about this racist toddler idea. Keith Boykin, you accuse CNN of running a fake video of black and white children hugging in the street, but CNN actually ran the real video of these kids back in September. You're the one spreading fake news. Mm-hmm. And there are some people underneath this video, as the president posted, who actually believe that it is true. But let me help you out with this a little bit. Toddler is spelled wrong, and it's got only one D in this version. So it's toddler.
You know, it's interesting, Femi, that almost every time somebody actually puts something fake out there or somebody comes at you as a troll on Twitter, they always spell things wrong. They always spell things wrong. So it makes a lot of sense. We have time for one more that I want to get to, and that is, you saw the hashtag Executive of the United States was popular today, and you thought it was referencing the president, but actually it was about something else.
Yes, it was about the original military order that announced that the enslaved people of Texas were no longer enslaved, which gives us the day of Juneteenth. And remarkable that this document, this handwritten military document, is being circulated right now because the National Archives have just found it. Perfect timing, National Archives, for Juneteenth.
And we'll link to it at hereandnow.org. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks, as always. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Jeremy. You too.
Another Confederate monument came down overnight, this one in Decatur, Georgia. The Lost Cause Monument is the latest in a long list of monuments or statues that have come down in recent weeks following the death of George Floyd and the nationwide protests over police brutality and racial injustice. Among them, a statue of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy in Frankfort, Kentucky. A statue honoring Confederate soldiers in Jacksonville, Florida. In Indiana, a monument for Confederate soldiers who died in a Union prison camp. And in Fredericksburg, Virginia, an 800-pound slave auction block was removed. Joining us now is Vernon Burton, professor of history at Clemson University. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this extraordinarily important time.
Well, and you're there in South Carolina, which was the first state to secede from the Union ahead of the Civil War. Are you seeing a reckoning with the past there?
I really am, Jeremy. And we, I think, are living through a revolution, not unlike the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, good revolutions are both exhilarating and a time of awareness. And it's also, I think, a really teachable moment about what both history is and how we commemorate history and how we learn our history.
Well, taking the statues and monuments down, of course, does not end racism. What does it mean when they come down? What does it signify to you?
Well, one of the things is that the incredible last few years, we're seeing what college professors, college historians have known a long time, what these monuments have represented. When you look at a monument, the first thing you have to do is ask, is it a monument to Robert E. Lee, or is it a monument that was put up for some other reason? And it's both, usually. They were put up at a certain time to represent, in fact, white supremacy at a time in particular when black people in the South are being denied their political rights, and it all ties together. What we're seeing, I think, though, is a result of years of teaching that have reached out now to public school teachers, and better history is being taught so that we can put these things much more into their proper context. In the American South is now a much more pluralistic society. It is a pluralistic society. But I think it's going to take a long time. These things can also have a backlash. What it means, we must, I think, also understand that while seeing a Confederate statue at the courthouse, which are throughout the South, you know, thousands of these monuments went up between 1890 and particularly 1910, 1920 in this Jim Crow period. While that may represent to one group of citizens, Confederate soldiers, their bravery in fighting, to another, it stood at the courthouse entrance, which said, you will not receive justice here, to another group of citizens. So these things are very symbolic, and they mean different things to different people.
Well, what do you say to people who say this is going too far? Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri is blocking an effort to remove Confederate statues from the U.S. Capitol building. And we've heard others say that if you start down this road, you'll have to rename Washington, D.C. because George Washington owned slaves.
Well, I think they're easy. We've always changed things. Things change. But I think we have good models. We have good models where Baltimore and particularly New Orleans held public hearings to make decisions, to have their citizens make decisions. Remember when so many of these things went up, African Americans were not even at the political table. It's not till 1965 that you get the Voting Rights Act, and then it's not until the 1970s you even begin to get African Americans elected to state legislators. Most of these monuments, now not all, but most of them were put up by private organizations like the United Daughters of Confederacy, on public land without the approval, really, of all the citizens. And then later state legislatures, particularly those dominated by whites, many of them just all white at the time, take them over and pass laws like Heritage Act laws that say that it's makes it very difficult to get these changes made. But I never thought I'd live to see the day when John C. Calhoun's statue would be removed in Charleston, South Carolina, but the mayor just announced that. That's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Well, I remember we spoke with you when South Carolina decided to remove the Confederate flag from the State House grounds back in 2015, which was a really stunning moment. But in Mississippi, the Confederate battle flag is still part of the state flag. Do you think something like that can last in this environment?
I'm not certain. I was wrong because I thought that it would be much more difficult to get the Confederate flag down when it came down. But remember, under the horrible circumstances, which we've just had the 5-year commemoration of the Mother Emanuel massacre, right. And so much of that, I think, was because there was a state legislature who was murdered, who was beloved, and secondly, even more important was the reaction of the families of the massacred victims who spoke of grace and forgiveness that then spoke across a culture in the South of religion that's similar for blacks and whites. So special time. This seems to me much more like the civil rights movement, triggered by seeing in this new social media world, the actual events of something like George Floyd's death, basically a public lynching, and realizing what all of this has meant symbolically to so many people. So at the same time, when, as with the Confederate flag coming down and with the civil rights movement of the 1960s, when businesses get behind these changes, I think that impossible becomes possible. But I also think we need to have education. People learn. And there's a generation that was taught in the history books that these symbols mean something very respectful, something that they're to cherish as part of their heritage. And I think we still have a long way to go in explaining that they also mean other things and that they were put up for the specific purposes, not just of recognizing Robert E. Lee or Jefferson Davis as leaders, but to make a statement about white supremacy. So you have to ask both of these questions, exactly what was the monument about? If you think back about it, the sort of propaganda starts with when Brown v. Board happened. Mississippi is just one example, passed a law, the legislature did, that said we have to teach Mississippi history. As a historian, I love that. But the reason was to preserve our way of life. And what was that way of life? It was segregation. It was, at best, having African Americans as second-class citizens. And we understand that now. And there's certainly been, for the last 20 years, in colleges, it's been understood. And I really think that the heroes, and they really are heroes, who teach in the public schools have done a tremendous job in changing the way our history has been taught so that people better understand what all of these symbols mean.
Do you think that the military bases that are named after Confederate generals like Fort Bragg in North Carolina, do you think those names will survive this?
unless the president vetoes it or stops the military, I doubt it, but I think you might want to consider keeping Fort Bragg, where I did my basic training, because he was such a bad general that it helped the Union win the Army, even though he was a Confederate general. So there's a little bit of irony in renaming Fort Bragg. But I just don't know. You know, historians are not very good prophets. But I think eventually they will be chased. We forget that the Civil War was about disunion, that the attack on Fort Sumter is like 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. And that's how those in the Union really experienced it. We rewrote this history so that we don't remember that every single Confederate state had a regiment of whites who fought for the Union, and that African Americans ran away from slavery and fought for the Union. And Lincoln said those African American soldiers made a huge difference in winning the war. So it was a much more divided society than the monuments we look at today on the landscape would tell us. In fact, these monuments were partly about creating a unity that was not there even during the Civil War among white Southerners. And that is part of the role that they have played, is creating that unity. So I think we need to think about that as well as we do it. The other side, and it's rather sad, is it does mean something to many white Southerners that is different and that they cherish. So, and that they identify as part of their ethnicity. And particularly as times are changing so dramatically in this country and everywhere, from recessions to the pandemic, all of these things, I think, add into why this is a revolutionary moment. When what was impossible becomes possible.
That is Vernon Burton, a professor of history at Clemson University. Professor Burton, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
In honor of Juneteenth, companies like Nike and Target are giving workers the day off to commemorate the day that Black Americans in Texas first found out they were free, more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Some are praising the decision to commemorate, while others feel it's a cheap optics play, if not backed up by further corporate changes. And for more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, we mentioned Target and Nike. What are some of the other companies allowing workers to stay home or paying them extra today?
So several companies are among the sort of big household names. JCPenney and Spotify are allowing employees to take a paid day off. But there are dozens of companies that are commemorating Juneteenth in some way or another. For example, JPMorgan Chase is closing its bank branches early. The car makers General Motors and Fiat Chrysler are observing a moment of silence. And interestingly, in New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio has actually declared that next year will be a holiday in the city and the schools for Juneteenth. So there are quite a lot going on.
Yeah. What's been the response so far? I guess what you're hearing from folks about this idea of it becoming kind of a holiday that's celebrated across the board.
You know, like you pointed out in the introduction, most of the response, or at least a lot of the response, has been at least lukewarm positive. But like you said, there's this caveat that this doesn't really solve the bigger issue of disparities in corporate America. For example, the Business Week cover story this week highlights how there are still only four Black CEOs among the Fortune 500 companies. And the story discusses, well, what can be done about that, asking if perhaps it's time to rethink the notion of quotas, which has always been sort of a controversial topic in corporate America. But it's clear that, you know, I think most people believe the holiday is a good start, but it needs to be backed up with more discussion about solving these bigger issues.
Yeah, we've also been talking about this week a lot of companies trying to make other changes, like Pepsi changing the name of the Aunt Jemima syrup, Mars changing the name of Uncle Ben's rice. What other actions are we seeing companies take, maybe perhaps that's taking that next step that you mentioned around diversity within the higher up ranks of companies?
But there's been quite a few interesting actions being taken, and not just in the U.S. In Great Britain, the insurance company Lloyd's of London and the company Green King, which is a owner of pubs and a brewer, they've basically both acknowledged their ties to slavery and said they will pay reparations to some charities. And even the Bank of England, you know, basically the equivalent of the Federal Reserve of Britain, has apologized for its links to slavery. Another interesting one was at the University of Florida. They banned this gator bait cheer at sporting events because it has a really horrendous racial backstory to it.
With the 30 seconds I have, you mentioned New York acknowledging Juneteenth as a holiday, also Texas and Virginia. Will this pave the way for it being a federal holiday, do you think?
I think there's bound to be a lot of discussion about that, and it'll be interesting to see if it really gains any ground. Obviously, who wouldn't want another holiday, right?
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Today is Juneteenth. It was on this day, 155 years ago, the enslaved people of Texas were informed they were free, 2 years after Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation formally abolished slavery. This year, the day is getting widespread attention as people throughout the country protest against police brutality and racism. But there is a long tradition of celebrating Juneteenth in many Black American communities, and one of those yearly celebrations includes Miss Juneteenth beauty pageants. One of those pageants is now the subject of a new feature film titled Miss Juneteenth, and actor Nicole Beharie stars as Turquoise, a former Miss Juneteenth winner.
When I was a kid, I used to go to the pageant every year, dreaming that one day I'd be up there. And the girls that won looked like they were floating. And they had all this hope and promise. I felt that when I won.
But for Turquoise, that promise went unfulfilled, and she hopes her daughter Kai can win this year's pageant and take advantage of the opportunities that come with the crown. This film, Miss Juneteenth, is available now on demand, and we're joined via Skype by its star, Nicole Beharie. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Nicole, I mean, what a moment that we're in right now. And what a moment for this film to be released.
Yeah, it's surreal. I couldn't have imagined shooting this a year ago and really just becoming familiar with the holiday, Juneteenth. I had planned on celebrating this year for the first time, but now it brings on a whole nother meaning.
What does this day represent for you?
It's a bittersweet holiday. And it kind of parallels with the story that we're telling, you know, sort of a dream deferred. We're celebrating freedom, but it's freedom that's been delayed. I feel like that's really pretty resonant with the moment that we're in right now.
Yeah, it speaks to Juneteenth in that this celebration came 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, and also the complexity of American history that's often left out, which is another thing that I like about the film that we made, is that like all the characters are flawed and they're well-meaning and there's space to sort of see things from a lot of different perspectives. I think that also speaks to just like the complexity of this moment. Like nobody is completely right. Nobody is completely wrong. I usually start work with like a question and being Turquoise, like, so much is uncertain and so much of your life is in flux that I feel like a year ago, I could not have imagined how much people I think will relate to that now. You know, people don't know what's going to happen financially with their health, with their futures, the future of their children. And that's really where we find this character.
Let's talk a little bit more about the character. So both your character, Turquoise, and her daughter in the film are so familiar to me. I mean, I was in a few pageants and cotillions as a young adult.
Really?
I know. Yeah, cotillions. I mean, man. I mean, it really spoke to me, that idea of looking at the debutantes and thinking about your future. I remember being really young and I'd go to these cotillions. My cousins were in them. And just the hope and the promise of the future, you know? Mm. As part of the prize in this film, Miss Juneteenth gets a scholarship to a historically Black college, which means everything for your character, Turquoise. Let's listen.
That scholarship made me feel like I finally had a chance. My life could have been different if I would have stuck with it. That's what I want for you.
You live this character during the filming. What does the pageant represent for you?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Wow. I have a complex relationship with pageants. I probably shouldn't say this. Mm-hmm. I've never been in one myself. You know, I was like a theater kid, nerd, weird person. So they probably wouldn't have wanted me anyway in anybody's pageant. But I kind of see the pageant in this as like one of the doors of opportunity. And Turquoise is really stubborn about wanting her daughter to walk through that particular door. A little bit of the pageant to me is holding on to the past, and because it was so personal to her, because she had won. And like, how many of us feel like our best days are behind us, especially as a woman, an actress that's getting older? Mm. That's another one of the questions that I've been asking myself, and probably
really?
Through this,
yeah.
Through this film, is like, are your best days behind you? What does that feel like, and how does that change the way that you move in the world? And I think Turquoise believes that at the beginning of this film.
Hmm. Writer-director Channing Godfrey Peoples, she set mm-hmm. this film in Fort Worth, Texas, where she grew up as a child of a single mother. How much did her memories shape your performance?
Oh, my goodness. Even what you're playing, that speech that Turquoise gives to Kai, those words that she's saying are almost verbatim out of, Channing's mouth.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. Like, I got there and, you know, she's from this community in Fort Worth, Texas. And they were, I mean, a real community. Like, everyone rallied around. A lot of the actors are actually locals and people that frequent all the bars and the church and the pageants. So it was 100% her baby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with that came, like, you know, go hang out with my cousins and work on your dialect, you know. And
oh, wow.
Work in the bar. Yeah, I like worked in the bar for like, a few weeks, maybe a week or two.
Yeah. You mentioned for Turquoise, this pageant represents looking to the past. Mm-hmm. Do you still feel like there's a place for beauty pageants like this? And what do they represent in this current moment?
I've been reading this, like, traditional West African spiritual teacher named Maladoma Somme, and he talks about the need for ritual and for rites of passage for youth. And something like this, where you're bringing the teenage girl or boy or whomever into the awareness of what the values are and how much the community values them. I do think that there's something there. Does it have mm-hmm. to be in the format of putting a dress on and winning a prize? I don't know, but I definitely feel like there's something there that I wish that I had even had. Mm-hmm. Seeing the confidence and the sort of well-spoken poise of some of these young ladies.
You went to Juilliard. You also appeared in Shame, The Express, and TV shows like Sleepy Hollow. I know you from Black Mirror. There's a lot of talk lately about not only diversity in Hollywood, but a centering of Black and Brown narratives and leadership roles in particular. Are you thinking about this in this moment that we're in?
Absolutely. What's interesting is we're seeing people, you know, social media is kind of taking over and we're seeing all kinds of content and people not having to wait for the usual gatekeepers to do things. And I think even during the coronavirus, it kind of leveled the fields.
Hmm.
You start thinking of like how you can create outside of what you thought was possible, which kind of harkens back to the story, like reimagining what is storytelling now and who says that a story that's simple. Like, I've had a lot of people say about Miss Juneteenth it's just so simple. I was like waiting for some big kaboom or something to happen. I think there are particular tropes and stereotypes whenever there are people of color or Black people on camera. So yeah, even some of the parts that you talked about, like, you know, leaning into some of the taboos and just creating material that's coloring outside of the lines of what we tend to see.
Yeah. Do you think this is a moment of real change?
This might sound a little cynical, but Hollywood has a legacy of supporting stereotypes internationally. You know what I mean? You have master storytellers that are controlling the narratives, and could they potentially manipulate and continue to control them in ways that serve an old paradigm? I don't know, perhaps. Yeah. I hope that changes. But to sort of bring it back to the movie, when you have communities like this or ritual or elders that sort of look back and you have like evidence of the strength of the people and their love and hope for the future generations, then those other storytellers who may not have your best interest in mind have less power.
What do you hope audiences take away from Miss Juneteenth?
That there's an opportunity to like reimagine ourselves when our life shows up a little differently than what we expected it to be. That like our best days are not behind us if we make it so. It's going to take some work, but hopefully, hopefully.
Nicole Beharie stars in the new film, Miss Juneteenth. Nicole, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We've been hearing a lot about how police are using drones and even facial recognition software to get an upper hand on protesters demonstrating against police brutality in recent weeks. But what about the technology the protesters are using? For more, let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Jeremy.
So tell us about some of the tech that protesters are using.
So protesters are using some things like end-to-end encrypted communication at the protests themselves. You might have heard of this popular app called Signal, which is really just a messaging app, but it's really had a spike in growth and popularity in recent weeks for sending messages. There's also a lot of settings on your phone you can use at protests to sort of avoid being tracked or avoid giving up information to law enforcement. One of those things is just turning on airplane mode, for instance. But there's another thing where you can actually disengage the fingerprint lock or the facial recognition lock on your phone, because law enforcement makes this distinction between what you are and what you know. And you might have to use your fingerprint to unlock your phone, but you don't have to give up your password. That's protected under the Fifth Amendment.
Now, protesters have also been using hashtags, and this has been going on for a long time. We remember they did this in Iran years ago. But in this case, hashtags like Black Lives Matter, and there's even been some anger at other people using that hashtag because it drowns out important information about the protests on the hashtag. But how have we seen the use of hashtags evolve when it comes to organizing?
Right. So, and as you said, you know, hashtags are this useful tool at protests because it sort of allows you to click on a simple link or a hashtag to get information that's happening in real time. So information on the ground from the protest itself. It's also how people organize, how people kind of get involved. But of course, there's some trickiness there. And, you know, this can sometimes go sideways. As you mentioned, you know, we saw this huge influx of influencers and people not really participating in the protest themselves to use the Black Lives Matter hashtag and post social media posts on Instagram with their posts blacked out. Now, this was, you know, somewhat well-intentioned, but activists pointed out that if you're posting and using this hashtag, you're clogging up the feed instead of stepping back and letting users, you know, see the messages of people you're trying to support. And also, you know, when people click on the hashtag, instead of important information regarding the protests themselves, they're seeing your stuff. So there is some trickiness there. And, you know, that's part of the whole thing with these protests is they pop up organically and some of the tools pop up organically too. And so it can start to get tricky with how they're being used.
Now, there's also been an explosion in apps that let people listen to police scanners. Tell us about those.
Yes. So as a former newspaper reporter who spent like way too many Sundays on the cop's desk, Jeremy, I have less than fond memories of like dragging around a police scanner with me. but of course, these days there's an app for that, as they say. There's one called 5-0 Radio that shot to the top of the Apple App Store recently. And they're becoming really popular. It's also important to note that in the wake of 9/11, police departments have started to make the argument that because of terrorism, it's important to encrypt these lines of communication for first responders. And, you know, the popularity of these apps may spur new calls for doing that, but we're also in a moment where there is a lot of momentum towards more transparency in law enforcement. And obviously, these apps and police scanners allow that, and encrypting that stuff would not allow it.
So the protesters are getting more technologically advanced. The police are getting more technologically advanced. What does that do to the dynamic? Does that give the edge to the protesters or the police right now?
That's a good question. I mean, it's always a cat and mouse game with these things, Jeremy. I think, you know, it's true that the pure virality of smartphone video of the protests, for instance, which really started years ago in Ferguson and is just becoming more and more prevalent and really exploding in recent weeks, this is a galvanizing force. And it's something that protesters are using more and more to get people involved, but also to show examples of police misconduct. And the power of video to really observe and document what is happening is, you know, I think probably arguably a good thing in an open society. But the tactical use of technology, the idea of hacking police scanners, the more weaponized technology on either side with protesters or police to kind of escalate might be not a great thing for the near future peaceful protest either.
That is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, as we wrap up this hour and wrap up this week, I just wanted to take a moment to note that it has been a difficult week in the world of public radio. Our station, WBUR, joined a number of other organizations in laying off many longtime employees because of the recession. These are hardworking people dedicated to the incredibly important mission of public radio. They are our friends. They are part of the public radio family. These talented people have kept you informed. Whether you know them or not, they're part of your life, too. So don't forget to support your public radio station. Quality, independent journalism has never been more important, and we can't let COVID-19 and its economic effects weaken it. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.